You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Steeder.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Wednesday, April 2nd, 2014. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the three-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, what unions no longer do. Professor Jake Rosenfeld on what unions no longer do for us. Also on the program today, breaking, the Supreme Court has ruled in the McCutcheon case. It is a campaign finance case that we discussed a couple of times over the past couple of months. Josh Orton from Progressives United will be here to tell us exactly what the implications will be. Also on the program today, tomorrow, Senate Intelligence Committee is expected to vote on a partial release of its 6,300-page torture report. Two senators came out today and said the impermissible word torture to explain what is in that report. Also on the program today, Yemeni citizens will band together to form a drone strike union. Day after Obamacare reaches its projected enrollment numbers, let the unskewing begin. And, of course, also Pat Robertson weighs in with Jews shining their diamonds. So, if I have time in between my diamond shining that I always like to do on Wednesdays, we will get to that.
Shmuley, can we start late today? I'm shining my diamonds.
Folks, just a programming note. Next week, we will be down in, or at least towards the end of the week, we'll be down in Las Vegas for the Mass Torts Convention. We have a couple of very good guests lined up for you. That will be enjoyable. The following week, so we're talking almost 2 weeks from now, is Mila's vacation, and I will be taking vacation as well. Matt and Mike will do a couple of shows. We'll have some best ofs for you, perhaps a pre-tape or two. Just a note on yesterday's show. Apparently at the beginning of the show yesterday, Matt accidentally spilt one of his soda pops on the board, short-circuiting the board, and some of you may have, for whatever reason, the internet tubes got, the streams were actually crossed. And apparently some of you got some type of right-wing morning zoo type of show. I'm not exactly sure what it was. Unfortunately, for those of you who were not listening live, the interview I did with President Obama, Michael forgot to hit the record button on the local recording. And so that's just one of those things that happens, and that interview, I thought, went very well. I
thought that moment where President Obama actually called you, I have to abbreviate, obviously, an MF-er, was kind of stunning, actually.
Well, I think he was doing that more in like you, like a sort of like you old so and so,
you persistent MF for you, right. Sam Cedar.
I
sort of took it to him.
I apologize for what I did yesterday, but I haven't heard Michael apologize.
I think obviously not recording the interview with President Obama creates broader content for the audience. So I wouldn't, just think there's some value to it.
How does that happen?
So what the members would want.
All right, let's not waste any more time. And when we come back, we'll be talking to Professor Jake Rosenfeld.
Sorry, boss.
We are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome to the program University of Washington Associate Professor of Sociology, Jake Rosenfeld, author of his new book, What Unions No Longer Do. Welcome to the program, Jake.
Thanks, Sam. It's a real pleasure to be on with you today.
So before we get to what unions no longer do, just give us a sort of a, and we've talked quite a bit on this program over the years as to the decline of unionism in this country. But just give us a brief sort of historical view of the, I guess, the rise and the fall of unionism in this country.
Sure, absolutely. So if you look at the private sector in the United States, unionism really took off throughout the 1930s into the 1940s, and then really hit its peak in the late 1940s, early 1950s. So then about a third of the non-farm workforce was organized, so one out of every three workers out there. Then the decline began, and it really gained speed throughout the 80s into the 1990s. And today we're talking about in the private sector a unionization rate in the mid-single digits, so about one out of every 20 workers today in the private sector is organized. And I should say that we should separate out what's been happening in the private sector from what's been happening in the public sector. In the public sector, up until a couple of years ago, unions had remained quite strong and had unionization rates in the public sector of about 33%. That's fallen a little bit in recent years with all the fights we've seen in state houses, especially in some of the Midwestern states, Wisconsin, Michigan, and
so,
the like.
So, let's talk about what contributed to the demise, at least in terms of private sector unionship, and then we'll talk about why it's different within the context of public unions.
Absolutely. So beginning in the 1970s into the early 1980s, we had a kind of a global economic recession. At the same time, you had some real important technological changes in certain key industries that unions had successfully organized. These changes and the rise of global markets, these changes put labor movements across the industrialized world under real pressure. So you see declines kind of across the industrialized world. But almost nowhere did you see the scale of the decline that we've experienced here in the United States. And that's, I think, due to a couple of pretty unique factors. One, businesses got organized. They came together and kind of drew up a real conscious strategy for how to rid companies of existing unions and how to prevent new ones from coming in. That coincided with a political turn to the right. And what has happened is that unions have kind of sought to pass legislation to rebalance the playing field when it comes to our laws governing collective bargaining. And anti-union opponents have proven incredibly successful at blocking every single possible legislation time and time again over these past few decades.
And would you say that Taft-Hartley was set up the context, excuse me, the context in which the sort of the anti-unionization efforts were able to succeed? I mean, it seems to me that just like corporations can't exist without government setting regulations and chartering them, unions also can't exist or flourish without the ability to unionize in some respects.
I think that's absolutely right, and it's a great point, and it's what sets us apart, I think, from many of our peer nations. So Taft-Hartley in the mid-20th century was the kind of last major piece of labor legislation we've had passed, and what we've seen since then was is one kind of failed attempt after another by unions to try to pass a kind of more pro-labor piece of legislation. And the result today, and this is sometimes kind of lost in contemporary debates about unions' current plight, is that if you're an employer in the private sector pretty much committed to keeping a union out, there's almost nothing the union can do to kind of buck your will. It is the organizing environment out there today is almost impossible if you're up against a committed anti-union employer.
And I think the sort of the ability that was sort of stripped away in some respects to Taft-Hartley, the ability to sort of unionize an industry as opposed to a shop, and
that's right.
The getting rid of the idea of sort of wildcat strikes. And strikes that would run across an industry, it created a dynamic internally in the unions that also has proved to be fairly problematic.
I think that's absolutely right. So the ban on secondary boycotts, the ban on wildcat strikes, and this kind of establishment-level bargaining in the private sector as opposed to industry-wide bargaining, really decentralizes a labor movement in a way that we don't see in many other countries, and in a way that, combined with the rise of kind of real giant kind of corporate conglomerates, puts labor at an increasingly difficult position. So if you're interested in organizing a McDonald's, the company, you have to go establishment by establishment by establishment, and that's just an incredibly uphill battle.
And it's also, I mean, it seems to me, we were talking last week about the Chicago teachers strike, and
right.
One of the sort of the successful aspects of that strike was the organizing that took place in the years prior to the strike and developing relationships in the broader community by sharing a broader agenda than just which benefits in the most narrow sense the members of the union.
Right. I think this is a good point, and there's been real serious internal debate within the labor movement for years now over this issue. But I would say, and I don't want to be too pessimistic here, let's take Justice for Janitors campaign, right? Began in the late 80s, early 1990s in Southern California, really successful at galvanizing community groups, broader constituencies by the unions interested in organizing, disproportionately immigrant, disproportionately female building cleaners. And it was a really successful campaign. It took years and years and years and a ton of resources. Incredibly successful. One of the few bright spots for private sector organizing in the last couple of decades. You look today, the percentage of janitors who are union has fallen from when Justice for Janitors began. The percentage of Hispanic janitors who are unionized has fallen from when Justice for Janitors began. So I think that speaks to a broader structural difficulties labor faces. Even when they do everything right, the best they can hope for in recent years in the private sector is to tread water. And that, speaks to a real difficult organizing terrain out there, even for those unions that are proactive, that have large organizing budgets, that are really conscientious at reaching out to broader community groups, community leaders, and others.
I want to come back to that because that speaks to sort of what can happen in the future. But let's
sure.
Just also touch on why did we see this sort of this paradox of the declining unionization in the private workforce, but not so in the public force. I mean, give us a sense of what the dynamics at play there.
Yeah, so in the public sector, unions really rose in the 1960s into the 1970s, and here organizing is set is subject to a whole different set of dynamics and rules. So let's just take a particular case from the kind of turn of the 21st century, not too long ago, home health care aides in Illinois. So what happened there is, you know, a really kind of ambitious union, SEIU, went out and convinced, really worked hard and lobbied state legislators and convinced the governor at the time to reclassify, and we're hearing a whole lot about the classification of workers in recent days, but to reclassify home health care aides, health care workers as state employees. And what that did is that all of a sudden the bargaining unit doesn't become an establishment or an individual home, someone who hires a home health care aide, but it becomes the state. And in the kind of stroke of a pen by this reclassification, all of a sudden, you know, tens of thousands of home health care aides become liable to join a union. And that's exactly what they did. They voted for a union. The state, in this case, you know, the state of Illinois, said, we're not going to oppose it. And just like that, voila, you had about 40,000 new union members. That kind of lack of establishment by establishment bargaining that you see in the private sector, and where in kind of pro-labor states, the few that remain, where you don't have opposition from the employer, in that case, the relevant politicians, means that it's just much more, it's much easier, or it's proven much easier on friendly political terrain to unionize in the public sector than it is in the private sector.
And structurally speaking, I mean, this gives us sort of an inkling as to what could have been, right? Because a state functions almost more like an industry than
right.
a specific shop, I mean, or a specific business. It functions more, I mean, this is, I guess, not necessarily, it's a little bit messy of an analogy, but it functions more as an industry in terms of the perspective of a union that is trying to unionize.
Right. I think that's a brilliant analogy. I think that's absolutely right. And it shows that, you know, that our kind of the fall in unionization, this is something that you hear in kind of contemporary discourse as well, as well, we don't need unions and workers don't want unions. Well, actually, you know, if you look at the public sector, there is plenty of evidence that workers do desire some form of collective representation at work. And when the rules of bargaining are such that it's more kind of industry-wide, there's not kind of a real hostility from the employer, that unionization can actually take off and remain stable in the United States.
All right, so let's turn to what unions did. I mean, some of it's obvious, but some of it definitely less so. What did unions do that they no longer do?
Yeah, so the kind of dominant narrative is we tend to focus on how unions lifted the wages of male, disproportionately white, blue-collar workers who worked previously unionized jobs. So what I try to set out in the book is to look at some of the kind of less covered benefits that a strong union movement in the United States once provided. So I look in depth at how for a couple of decades in the middle 20th century, unions were really instrumental in lowering racial inequality levels, especially among women workers in the private sector, on raising average wage levels for African-American men. I look at how unions provided a bridge to the middle class for many of the earlier generations of immigrants and their children, and how that kind of bridge has crumbled today. Politically, so we just had a Supreme Court decision come out this morning. The book, I really look at how unions were successful at countering corporate power and corporate financial power in our elections, thereby reducing political inequality in all sorts of important ways. And then finally, culturally, about how a strong union movement, a movement that had organized one out of every three workers in the U.S., how it served as a kind of powerful normative voice for the interests of non-elites in our economy and in our polity.
And, you know, some of your book is obviously based on research you did back, I think it was in 2011, on just on quantifying how much of our income inequality is a function of the loss of that, I guess, ballast within both the body politic and our economy.
Yeah, and so that was work I had done with Bruce Western of Harvard University. And what we did there is looked at union decline in the private sector and how much it has contributed to rising inequality. Unlike many of the past analyses on this topic, we took a broader view and looked at how unions affected the wages of non-union workers in highly organized industries and highly organized locations. And we found substantial effects for a strong union movement on non-union, on lifting non-union worker wages. And this happened in various ways. One was that if you're a new business owner, you hire a bunch of workers, you're looking to set pay scales, set your benefit packages, you often look to what the business leader in your particular industry is doing and mimic what they're doing. When unions were strong, many of these business leaders were unionized firms. So regardless of whether your own workers are unionized, all of a sudden you're paying union-level wages and union benefit packages. So that was one way, this kind of spread of norms that unions helped set when they dominated many key industries. And the other way is through threat effects. So here the concept's pretty simple. If you're a non-union employer really interested on remaining non-union, one tried and true way is to keep your workers happy, and one way to keep your workers happy is to pay them comparatively well, and oftentimes many non-union firms would just match the union pay levels and benefit scales. And so here again, you see non-union workers benefiting from a strong union presence. And non-union workers benefiting from unions just serving bread and butter issues to their own union members. That's something that's often lost in discussions today. So once you combine the effects of unions on their own members and on non-union members, we found that among men, union decline in recent decades explains about a third of the rise of private sector inequality. And that's equivalent to what we find in terms of the role of growing education gaps, right, which is oftentimes the kind of key culprit pointed out by many others in discussions of rising inequality.
So wait, so in other words, so the decline of unionism is equal to at least what is perceived to be the cause of inequality relative to something like education.
Exactly, that's what we found at least among men in the private sector, and we look from the early 1970s, when data on this stuff began to be kind of usable, until the 2009-2010.
And so, I mean, so if one wanted to address income inequality at this point, obviously you'd get a third of the way there. I mean, this is excuse the sort of the broad swaths here, but you get a third of the way there if you could get back to some form of union, I guess, participation that we had during the 50s and the 60s. And so that doesn't seem like it's going to happen. So what happens next? I mean, I would imagine if there was a broader awareness of the implications of this during that time, it would have helped a little bit. But what do we do now?
Yeah, I don't think there's any magic bullet out there to solve labor's woes, but I think that we are in an interesting position right now. So you have everyone from the president on down talking about issues of inequality, talking about issues of poverty. He's out in Michigan today, I believe, talking about the need to raise the minimum wage. I think for organized labor, what they need to do is to highlight the connection between their own plight and all these issues that have gained a real, real prominence in the public discourse in recent months. By connecting these two issues that are usually discussed in isolation, organized labor and labor supporters can make clear that, look, you have to be really creative to think of a way to kind of significantly reverse inequality trends without a revitalized labor movement. Really creative. I mean, the cross-national picture is clear. The historical patterns in the United States are clear, right? Strong labor movements correspond with lower inequality and vice versa. And so doing that, bringing those two kind of strands together, issues usually discussed in isolation, might kind of awaken people who claim to be really interested in reducing inequality, in reducing poverty, and kind of restoring a stable middle class that organized labor has to play a key role there.
And of course, the challenge to this is that you have your strongest unions are at this point are public unions. They're the ones, I mean, you still have this ongoing dynamic, though, right? Is that even if you were to agitate within the context, I mean, I just use New York State as a prime example. We have a Democratic, at least in party affiliation, governor who has been very hostile to unions here. And yet they are still in this predicament of we've got to do business with this guy. We only, which gives us only so much sort of space, political space, to agitate for these broader issues.
I think that's right. I mean, you know, this is a longstanding debate and concern within the U.S. labor movement. The alternative, right, is a party increasingly explicit about opposing the very notion of collective bargaining, right, that notion. So you're talking, you know, you're along a spectrum of Democrats, many of whom today, you know, unions are important come election time, and other than that, they really don't see their use. And Republicans, many Republican elected officials today who are just openly hostile to the very idea of the labor union. So that's, you know, that's those are tough choices. That's the kind of system we're in. I think there is space, though, for unions to do more. And New York State actually is an interesting example. So the Working Families Party, right, heavily funded and organized by some of New York's labor unions, has been successful in grooming pro-labor candidates at the local, state, and the state level. And then if you look at New York City, this is the kind of machine that Bill de Blasio, a machine not in the old sense, in this kind of new right. sense, that Bill de Blasio emerged from. And there, I think there's somewhat of a model that can be used in other locales, just being much more kind of much more smart, forward-thinking, and thinking long-term about the candidates that you groom for state, local, and then, you know, hopefully this is going to be a long time off, national office. But again, this is not going to happen overnight by any means. And I think on the left, and there's oftentimes too much of a focus on the next presidential election, right, and not nearly enough on what progressive politicians can do on various levels. We've seen how important that is, looking at states like Wisconsin, looking at states like Michigan, looking at North Carolina right now. When you kind of capture the political party, the kind of political apparatus at the state level, that can engender real change, especially in a context of real gridlock in Washington.
There's been basically three big union stories, I think, in my mind anyways, over the past in 2014, one being the Boeing story, where union members made some pretty big concessions to Boeing over the threats of their moving. I think it was their 777 development, one of their big new airplanes. The other one being in West Virginia, in Chattanooga with Volkswagen. And the third being this ruling by the National Labor Relations Board that student athletes have the right to form a union. Just give me your sense of what those three stories tell us about what potentially, if they have broader implications on the broader union movement.
Right. I would say that so the Boeing story kind of exemplifies the plight of organized labor over the past couple of decades, right? That fits a common narrative. So this is a still organized company in a region of the United States where unions remain strong, retain strong political support, and even there, right? And it's a company that, despite their kind of public pronouncements, is not subject to hyper-competition or global competition on any large scale. This is aerospace. We're talking about a duopoly, and Boeing's competitor is not based in Bangladesh. It's anchored in France and Germany. And so even there, the union was forced, after a series of votes, to really make real serious concessions going forward. And the company played, you know, real hardball, and they did it because they had power on their side. They did it because they could. They did it because they had nearly two dozen other states begging for them to shift production and offering them, you know, billions of dollars in subsidies to do so. So that's kind of what we've seen. You know, if there's going to be a last shoe to drop, it's going to be the companies like Boeing. The VW case in Tennessee, you know, that I think finally what there was a little bit too much made of that in the nation's press. We're talking about auto manufacturing, and we're talking about a union of 1,600 workers. It seemed like a very symbolic vote in some ways. If there is going to be labor revitalization, I just don't see auto manufacturing as its future, because finally auto manufacturing is such a small fraction of the U.S. workforce. So Walmart employs something like 500,000 more workers than the entire auto manufacturing industry in the U.S. today. I think it was interesting in showing you know, what unions are up against, even when they have a company on their side. In this case, Volkswagen pledged neutrality, and from all reports, actually kept to its pledge. Despite that, there was, you know, very serious political opposition. This is currently a case that's being appealed. And it, for some reason, I was not on the ground by any means at all, but right. The union seemed a little caught off guard by all the kind of the marshaling of anti-union forces that really came in the last week or so.
In fact, I think in that case, in front of the National Labor Relations Board, in terms of where the union is charging outside interference, they asked for, I don't know if they got it, but they asked for an extension in bringing their case, because apparently there's new evidence of coordination
right.
between local politicians, by local, I mean statewide even, and federal,
right.
and Bob Corker maybe. And I guess what's telling to me was just the intensity, at least the perception
yes.
by those politicians that if this tiny, you know, relatively small drop in the bucket within the context of,
right.
of this happens, it may have long-term consequences for them.
Right. And I think a lot of that, I mean, I think that intensity is telling. I mean, the kind of hostility to unions by many U.S. employers and by many U.S. politicians is, I, you know, someone who studied this for over a decade now, still quite stunning, just absolutely stunning. And you saw it again marshaled in the Tennessee case there. And for whatever reason, the union seemed a little caught off guard, but
right.
that, I mean, I'm not sure there is anything else they could do, right? I mean, they had neutrality from the company. This was a long-term effort. And, you know, it was a narrow vote, and it fell short. But finally, that's not, I don't think, the future of unionism in the United States. It's a service sector-dominated economy, and there has to be some way to kind of make real serious inroads there if unions are going to do any, and we're not talking about revitalization of a third of the private sector, but if unions are going to crawl out of the single digits in private sector organizing. And then the Northwestern case, you know, this is, I think, an interesting one. A union for college athletes is still a long way off. You know, the NCAA is not Walmart, but like Walmart, they're going to oppose this with everything
right.
they have and tie it up as long as possible. I think it raises really interesting questions, though, about a broader phenomenon of classifying workers, right? So going beyond the ranks of college athletes, there are tens of thousands of workers out there who are classified as independent contractors by their employers in order to keep them out of enjoying any of the benefits of the Fair Labor Standards Act or any of the rights to unionize under the National Labor Relations Act. So you have truck drivers, you have home health care aides in many jurisdictions. You have occupation, construction workers, occupation after occupation, classified as independent contractors to keep them out of existing labor laws in the United States. And what I do hope is that out of all the attention to college athletes seeking unionizing, there's a broader discussion of misclassification writ large, because that's, I think, a really important issue and one that labor could do well to publicize.
Yeah, I mean, I think on some levels the implications of this are being a little bit undersold, because A, like you say, classification is one of those things too where there seems to be a lot more, you need a lot less political will, it seems to me, for the that a lot of that classification could be done theoretically, right, by the executive, right? I mean, couldn't that be done
right.
by the National Labor Relations Board?
And there's still, and yeah, I think the administration is actually doing some work on this now. It can be reversed if there's a new administration, you know, overnight. But yes, absolutely.
And it also seems to me that because the like from a cultural standpoint, that maybe I'm looking for hope in all the or any place I can find, I guess. But it right. seems to me that there's an opportunity there amongst college athletes because of where it's sort of situated culturally, that it can expand sort of the conversation, the implications of just what it means to be labor.
Yeah, I think so, and I think that that would provide a real opening, and that would for me, given the kind of small numbers of actual college athletes we're talking about, I think that would be the kind of best case scenario to come out of
right.
this, that we have a broader understanding and a broader discussion of what is a worker and what rights should a worker have in the contemporary United States in a very, very precarious economy.
All right, Jake Rosenfeld, author of What Unions No Longer Do. We will put a link up at majority.fm to your book. Thanks so much for your time today. Genuinely appreciate it.
Thank you. Have a good one.
All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we will be talking to Josh Orton from Progressives United. All right, folks, Sam Seder on the Majority Report. Breaking news this morning. The Supreme Court has struck down aggregate limits on federal campaign contributions in the case McCutcheon versus the Federal Elections Commission. On the phone, executive producer emeritus of the Majority Report and current political director at Progressives United, set up by Russ Feingold a couple years ago to deal with the tremendous amount of money in our politics. Josh, welcome to the program.
Hi, Sam. It's great to be on your show.
You know, we spoke about McCutcheon, I think it was, several months ago. I guess it must have been during the oral arguments. Tell us what this case was about.
So there's two different types of contribution limits. There's the ones that we're familiar with, the individual contribution limits, where I can give a candidate like Elizabeth Warren $2,600 a maximum in a primary and $2,600 in a general, or, like Barack Obama. And then I can only give a certain amount to political parties. And then there's what's called aggregate limits. And aggregate limits are set up so that basically wealthy donors have a max of the total amount of money they can contribute to any combination of candidates or party committees. And this election cycle, it's $123,000. So I can distribute that however I want across all the federal elections, all the House races, all the Senate races, but I can't go over that in any combination. And it's the same thing with parties. So I could contribute something like $32,000 to the DNC, but I couldn't contribute $32,000 to the DNC and $32,000 to the DSCC, the Senatorial Campaign Committee. So what this decision did was to wipe away those aggregate limits. So now I could give, if I wanted, for, you know, for a primary and general election, $5,200 to every political candidate in every House race, every Democrat or every Republican, for every House race in the country, plus Senate campaigns, plus I can give the maximum individual limit to all of the party committees I want. So it went from being able to spend about $123,000 overall to actually any individual contributor, if you sort of add up all the campaigns, being able to spend millions of dollars in hard money directly to campaigns and party committees per two-year election cycle.
And so now, okay, so let me ask you this. I can give as much as I want to the Republican Party now, right? Is that basically it?
No, there's still individual limits on committees, just as there's still individual limits on campaigns. What it means is you can max out to all the party committees you want to. So you can hit the maximum to the RNC. You can donate the maximum to the Republican senatorial committee. You can contribute the maximum to the Republican House campaign committee.
Are there any restrictions on how many committees the Republicans or the Democrats can set up? In other words,
it's unclear about party committees, but there's no limit on specific PACs, and that's one of the big questions. So. Overall, the question that the Supreme Court faced is whether this kind of thing, these limits, limit either corruption or the appearance of corruption. That's the basis that the Supreme Court has used for generations. But to your specific question, in practicality, what this has done is basically legalize money laundering among different campaigns. So one of the things that Justice Breyer pointed out in his dissent is that you might see donors set up these multiple PACs per candidate, where an individual can contribute the maximum amount to all those different PACs plus the candidate, and then those PACs can all just together donate that money to the candidate. So there's all these ways around it, and the Supreme Court, look, frankly, with this and the Citizens United decision, there's really no way around the fact that the Roberts majority here, and John Roberts wrote the majority decision in McCutcheon, they're being willfully ignorant about corruption. They're trying to sort of uphold this notion that quid pro quo corruption happens when somebody, you know, walks into a hotel room with a briefcase full of money, and they look at how it'll affect one election cycle or the next, and they've lost sight of the fact that money is corrupting on a much broader level, and so they're trying to make this distinction between quid pro quo corruption itself and simply influence. Or a donor ingratiating themselves to a candidate or to an elected official, and they say that there's a huge difference between those two, or there's at least a demonstrable difference between those two. But the funny thing is they've not actually done any research to figure out what that difference looks like. In the 2000s, when McCain-Feingold passed, and the Supreme Court looked at the constitutionality of that law, they took testimony. Russ Feingold testified under oath about what that kind of corruption of soft money looked like in the Senate cloakroom. The Supreme Court nowadays isn't doing that. They just think they know how politics works, or they say they think they know. And, you know, to John McCain's credit, he's still quite good on this, and his statement today, I think, was accurate, which is that there's going to be corruption scandals. There's no way around it. You know, the Supreme Court can stick their heads in the sand and pretend that what they're allowing isn't corruption, but it is, and, you know, it's almost like people aren't going to realize what it looks like until it happens, but I guarantee you it's going on.
Yeah, I mean, of course, and of course these scandals won't be illegal at that point, right? I mean, or you know, I mean, it seems to me that if I wanted to dump a lot of money into a specific race, what I would do is say, is call up and I guess there's only like 600-700 people who have hit these limits in the past, right? I mean, on any given year.
It's in the hundreds, yeah.
And so, obviously, the head of fundraising for all these committees, they take my call immediately if they're not already on the phone trying to reach me. And I say, oh, it's a new day. I've got all this money here, and I'm going to completely super max out. And, but I really like Josh Orton, who's running in Wisconsin. And I just want you to know that I'm going to give you all the money this year, but I would really like you guys to get behind that guy. And, you know, that may influence how much I want to give next year. What's to prevent them from saying, don't say another word, you know, message received. And then you give all this money to these committees and they dump it all in your race.
That kind of conversation could be possible, but the when it flows the other way, it's almost more pernicious. So think of it this way. You've got the Eric Cantors, the John Boehners of the world who are in leadership positions. You know, Steve Israel runs the Democratic House Campaign Committee. You know, you have those guys, and they know which donors can have been active in the past and can give this much money. Now, the Supreme Court doesn't think that these leaders, these elected leaders, can solicit. They're saying that they can't specifically solicit million-dollar checks to be distributed and basically laundered. But the way it works now with, say, a Super PAC fundraiser is you'll have Eric Cantor, you'll have a room full of 20 uber-wealthy donors who are given a presentation about which races are the most important and how resources are, you know, should be allocated. And then Eric Cantor will come in and say, hey, you know, we really appreciate what you're doing. You know, this is going to be a really important election, blah, 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 blah. Your support is so important, and I'm counting on you. And then he'll leave the room, and then the person running the fundraiser will then ask the people in the room to max out to every race in the country and every party committee. And, you know, the question is, what will the mechanisms look like where they can basically launder that money to be targeted in the races that are the most important? But they'll do that. So it really, like, the solicitation part of it, when it's actually the politicians, you know, asking for this, it's almost, what's the reverse of bribery? It's almost more pernicious when seen through the lens of extortion.
And so, I mean, at this point, and Buckley v. Valeo was sort of the, I guess, the big
landmark Supreme Court case.
Yeah, about campaign finance. What is left of that after this ruling?
Well, there's a couple things, and it's, you know, I guess you could say that there's a couple things, but nothing that can't be pretty easily worked around. I mean, obviously, McCain-Feingold banned unlimited corporate contributions directly to the party, so soft money. So you can't see, you know, FedEx can't write a six-figure check to the DNC a week before it has legislation before the Senate. But they can contribute to shadow groups that they know will be supporting Democratic candidates. You know, basically, the sort of inside track, the sort of like old-timey type of corruption that was stopped by individual contribution limits and the banning of soft money from McCain-Feingold, that still exists. But it's sort of like, you know, I'm starting to think about it as like, well, those laws are still important. You know, think about when somebody invented, you know, very sophisticated credit card wire fraud, right? It's like, well, you know, laws, you know, preventing, you know, making it illegal to stick up an armored car are still important. But if you're going to steal a huge sum of money, are you going to stick up an armored car or are you going to, you know, commit massive credit card wire fraud? So it's still important that those laws exist, but we now see a whole new universe that has to be addressed.
It's almost like an arms race, right, at this point. And in some respects, the side that was trying to inhibit campaign finance abuse has basically said, we're out of that game.
Yeah, and I think there's two other sort of broader points that I think are important. One is that Democrats have not been great on this. You know, Terry McAuliffe originally created the loophole for the sort of corruption that happened under soft money. Democrats play the same game. You know, they're like Republicans are playing in the majors. You know, Dems are probably playing maybe high AA ball, but it's still the same game. You know, we're never going to be able to win if we just sort of continue down the same losing road. You know, Democrats always say, well, we need to win to change the rules. And then they win, and then they never change the rules because soliciting this money, they start counting on it. They bake it into their plan for the next election. It's part of the strategy. And then they start sort of yoking their political agenda and their legislative agenda to make sure the money's there the next election cycle. So they're not that much better. And in the longer term, you know, I've said this before, it's not necessarily who wins the next election or who won or lost the last election. It's over the long term. Well, you know, when the Democrats, you know, basically sold their souls under soft money. You know, you repealed Glass-Steagall. You deregulated Wall Street. You know, when Democrats and Republicans are playing the same game over the long term, you know, corporations are basically running the show. And the second part of that is that, you know, just look at last week, what, you know, the arguments under Hobby Lobby. You know, I had a professor in undergrad who, a political science professor, I think it was Poli-Sci 101, and he said, you know, basically any question in politics can on some level be whittled down to the question of who decides, right? And I think that more so, it's not just campaign finance that's the problem with this Roberts Court. It's corporate rights just really overall. You know, you see what's going to happen or what could happen in Hobby Lobby. It's like, well, who's deciding? Is a woman deciding her own healthcare needs? Is a person, you know, who's deciding who gets elected in an election? More and more, this Roberts Court is saying the ultra-wealthy and corporations are deciding.
And so is there a legislative fix to that? I mean, obviously there isn't, right? I mean, because you can't, they've found that these caps are unconstitutional in some way. So statute's not going to help, at least in terms of like some type of frontal assault on this. I mean,
the most immediate legislation that people are sort of thinking about is, you know, we're talking about how the Supreme Court basically legalized money laundering, where you can give to all these different campaigns, but they'll basically find a way to sort of focus the money where it needs to go. You know, the most immediate thing is Congress could pass laws prohibiting that kind of, moving money around like that, to make sure that if someone's going to contribute to all the different campaigns across the country, then if they give money to a Republican who's running unopposed, it's going to stick with the Republican who's running unopposed, or it's going to stick with the state party who doesn't really have competitive races. But that requires Congress to do something. You know, there is a question of like just basic disclosure with the Disclose Act. The last several Congresses, they could never get to 60 votes, even though it was really obvious that it was necessary. So I'm pretty, you know, the notion that there's going to be some sort of legislative fix for this in the near future, or even legislation that would sort of mitigate the disaster of the McCutcheon decision today, I'm just not hopeful.
And so that makes things like public financing of campaigns that much more important, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's crucial, and it's interesting, too, because just this week, you know, all eyes were on New York as to whether Governor Andrew Cuomo, a Democrat who's long been campaigning and, you know, touting his support for public financing, whether he was going to actually walk the walk and make public financing a reality in New York, and he completely backed down. He completely capitulated to corporate interests. He has, insane connection to wealthy donors. And, you know, I don't want to say it's ironic, but it sort of points to how Cuomo's capitulation is almost more tragic in light of the McCutcheon decision, because where there's possible progress is on the state level. You see, you know, efforts for disclosure in California, public financing in New York. In a state like New York, if you pass public financing, you know, in such a big state with such a big budget and such powerful statewide offices, other states are going to look at it and say, oh, we could do that. The sky isn't going to fall. It's a template. And, it was a huge disappointment. And look.
But to be fair, I mean, he does have $34 million at least in his war chest. And you wouldn't want that to go to waste. I mean, if he was.
Well, and to be fair, he did apply public financing to the comptroller's race, where one of his political rivals currently sits.
Right. That was what the deal was in New York. We're just going to do this. It's not even a pilot program. This is what is sort of even more ridiculous about it. This is a one time, 1 year for one office, with a Democrat who's in that office who Cuomo does not like. And so he's saying, we're going to do campaign finance, but only for this one race and this 1 year. This is not even a pilot program. This isn't like we're going to see how it goes and we have automatic roll in for other offices. I mean,
as far as I'm concerned, if you look at what what Cuomo needed to do or what the what was possible this week in New York. As far as I'm concerned, Cuomo was on the side of the Roberts majority in McCutcheon because, you know, really that's the only solve to this, you know, to this absurd definition of corruption. Is when you have a democratically elected governor who's shown that he can pass things like gay marriage, just decides to let the pitch go by. I mean, I think it's an implicit endorsement of the McCutcheon decision today.
Yeah, that occurred to me as well. Well, Josh Horton, I appreciate your time today. We're obviously going to be talking about this for a while. This is sort of the stepbrother of Citizens United, and it's going to be with us. Let me ask you also about the timing, right? I mean, they made sure to get this decision down in time so that they could begin to impact this election, it seems to me.
Well, it's interesting. You know, Russ Feingold would say that Citizens United was hard to interpret Citizens United as anything but a reaction to the great grassroots fundraising, you know, apparatus that was created by Barack Obama's 2008 campaign. You know, he says that the corporate America saw the face of the populist movement and they were terrified. And I think that it's clear that, you know, you saw what happened with Bill de Blasio. You saw the gigantic fundraising ability that Elizabeth Warren has developed. And it's obvious that, you know, these corporate entities and these really heavy hitter, ultra wealthy Republican donors, you know, were scrambling to make sure that they could remove all these restrictions as quickly as possible.
Josh Horton from Progressives United, thanks so much for your time today, buddy.
Thanks, Sam.
Talk to you later. All right, folks, we're going to head into the funner half of the program. If you're a member of this program, I want to thank you. If you're not a member of this program, I want to thank you in advance for becoming a member. It's very easy to do. It's only pennies a day. You can become a member today at majority.fm. You can also support this program by buying your Amazon crap. If you buy crap from Amazon, through our link at majorityreportkickback.com. Majorityreportkickback.com. We call it that because if you click on the Amazon link, bookmark it, always go to that when you're buying Amazon stuff. We get a kickback. So we call it majorityreportkickback.com. JustCoffee.coop. There's a reason why it's .coop. It's because Just Coffee is an employee-owned coffee company in Madison, Wisconsin. Fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Get a coupon code majority. Get 10% off. The number is 646-257-3920. 646-257-3920. We'll be back in just a moment. You can also IM me. See you on the flip side.
Say to the bouquet.